And so today I'm honored to introduce Rebecca Jordan Young here with us to discuss her book, Brainstorm, The Flaws in the Science of Sex Differences. Of Brainstorm, Publishers Weekly writes that Jordan Young has written a stunning book that demolishes most of the science associated with the dominant paradigm of the development of sex and gender identity, behavior, and orientation. Jordan Young interviewed virtually every major researcher in the field and reviewed hundreds of published scientific papers. She explains in exquisite detail the flaws in the underlying science, from experimental design that make no statistical sense to conceptually sloppy definitions of male and female sexuality, contradictory results, and the social construction of normality. Her conclusion that the patterns we see are far more complicated than previously believed and due to a wider range of variables will shake up the research community and alter public perception. Rebecca Jordan Young is a sociomedical scientist whose research includes social epidemiology studies of HIV and AIDS and evaluation of biological work on sex, gender, and sexuality. She was deputy director of the Social Theory Corps at the Center for Drug Use and HIV Research and has been sponsored by the National Institute of Health. Ms. Jordan Young is a professor at Barnard College, where she teaches courses in science and technology studies, sexuality, gender theory, and HIV and AIDS. We are thrilled to have her with us this afternoon, so you please join me in welcoming Rebecca Jordan Young.
Thank you. It's absolutely my pleasure and honor to be here and to have yet another fantastic forum to talk about this book, which has been so exciting to me in the fact of its reception. I knew that I was taking on something that had been very broadly accepted, and I was half convinced that what I had to say would simply sink like a stone and that, you know, maybe a few people would nod, but that would be it. And instead, I've found that this is a moment in time where a lot of people seem to be ready to think a little bit differently about gender and sexuality and its relationship to the brain, and maybe that has to do with a very welcome turn in neuroscience, where a lot more people are thinking about plasticity and ongoing developmental models, and that in general the idea of hardwiring seems to be on its way out scientifically, which is really great news. It's not yet on its way out popularly. People are still talking and writing a lot about hardwiring as if that is a useful way to think about virtually any kind of personality trait, characteristic, behavior, etc. So actually, I'm going to borrow my own book from up here for a moment, and I will just briefly read to you from the preface, and then I might do a little bit more reading. Believe it or not, this is not the best read-aloud book. I'll mostly talk to you instead of read to you today. Most books set out to answer questions. This book sets out to question answers. The answers I question have to do with the nature and causes of differences between men and women and between straight people and gay people. Specifically, I question what we know about male and female brains or gay and straight brains. When Simon LeVay reported in 1991 that he had found a difference in brain structure between gay and heterosexual men, which was trumpeted as the discovery of the gay brain, I found it interesting but also puzzling. How could gayness take a single identifiable form in the brain when it takes such varied forms in people's lives? At the time, I had already been engaged for several years in large-scale sexuality research related to the AIDS epidemic. In an outreach storefront in Washington, D.C., I ran a project that focused on injection drug users. It was there that I first met a lot of gay men. These men were not the poster children of the gay rights movement, but were poor, struggling with addiction and recovery, and trying to avoid or outlive AIDS. And so were their heterosexual brothers, with whom I also worked. In fact, these men were so similar in demeanor, dress, and daily struggles that without our detailed interviews, it was impossible to tell the difference between the gay and straight men. In spite of our firm belief in our great gaydar, and in spite of the trumpeting of gaydar out there from a number of scientists, a number of prominent psychologists are doing research on what they call gaydar and confidently pronounce that you can really tell the difference. But my own work and the work of lots of other people who, especially people who work in more marginalized communities, indicates that what Gaydar shows you is community cohesiveness in a group of self-selected or fairly homogenous gay or lesbian people. And it's not very effective as soon as you step out of particular communities that you're not familiar with. In LaVey's study, the homosexual men were a singular type, unlike the also homogenous heterosexual men, and they were also similar to the presumably straight women. Those are common enough ideas, both inside and outside of science, but our research challenged these notions. What we did was go around and actually recruit people based on their proximity in a particular area to where we were recruiting, or based on their drug use habits. So we weren't actually screening people initially for anything to do with sexuality, but then we proceeded to ask everybody very detailed questions. And that kind of method avoids the sorts of biases that are overwhelmingly present in the research that looks specifically for causal associations with sexual orientation. Because in fact, the idea of causes for sexuality and sexual orientation wasn't what we were doing. That wasn't the aim of our study. We wanted to know about the variations in people's sexual behavior, their interests, their identities, and so on. But then we were able to take a look at that and look at how homogenous or not are people. And in a nutshell, to relate that sort of research, including not just the studies that I've been a part of, but a broad network of studies related to my own work that involved detailed information on sexual behavior from more than 70,000 drug users and their partners across 63 cities, there would be no way to come up with a profile of the sort that you would be able to slot people into the selection criteria for the studies used by people like Simon LaVey or Michael Bailey, or increasingly people who do a number of other studies that relate early hormone exposures on one hand to patterns of sexuality or gender on the other. So let me tell you a little bit about how people make those relationships. The point of this particular book was to actually investigate what you can think of as a one-stop shopping theory of gender and sexuality. And that theory is what I call brain organization theory. Now, I underscore that that's what I call it because, in fact, most often this idea is no longer identified as a theory. It's very often treated as a simple fact of human development. So we might actually even call it a paradigm that actually connects a number of different theories at this point. The basic idea is that early exposure to steroid hormones during a critical period of development while you're still in the womb might actually take what is initially a neutral, a sex-neutral brain, undifferentiated, and send it down a developmental path that's either masculine or feminine. And there's a lot of interesting work in other animals that suggests that hormones affect sexual behavior, affect a number of traits and characteristics that differ between the sexes if you administer hormones during this early critical period. But there are two problems with the way that theory has gotten extended to the idea of hardwired human brains. The first problem has to do with the animal experiments themselves, and that is that the idea that those differences caused by the early hormone exposures are permanent and are hardwired has mostly been assumed instead of empirically tested, even in animals. So in the book, there are a number of places where I point out studies that take these experimentally manipulated animals and then expose them to different kinds of interventions, handling, different sorts of handling, different caging conditions, exposure to animals that are sexually experienced versus inexperienced. Even a couple of hours in a cage with a sexually experienced animal can reverse the effects that are supposedly permanent from these early hormone exposures. So even in other animals, the idea of hardwiring is a pretty flimsy idea, and lots of developmental biologists in particular are for a long time not enchanted with that word and that notion. When you get to humans, there are a lot of other problems. For one thing, the sorts of traits and behaviors that are supposedly hardwired in the human brain are not nearly so dichotomous as they are in animals anyway. And in fact, for virtually every single trait, with the single exception of attraction to males versus females, for every other trait, there is more variety among men or among women than there is difference between the two groups. So the idea of a fundamentally sexed brain is already problematic just from the ground that it's standing on with the animal studies and the notion of what's the outcome actually look like. But giving it all that benefit of the doubt, I nonetheless wanted to say, what kind of evidence do we have from human studies that relate to this idea? So I did what is the first ever comprehensive analysis of the human data related to this theory. I have at this point looked at over 400 studies at the time that the book was drafted. When I say looked at, I mean really analyzed in detail. I've looked at more studies than that, but that actually includes pretty much the universe of human studies related to this theory. And I also interviewed the most important scientists who are doing this work. I did an influence analysis, and I identified the top 25 most cited scientists, and I got interviews with 21 of them. And I found a few things that were pretty stunning from the perspective of somebody who focuses on research design and on measures, as I've done in my own work. The first thing is that overwhelmingly the scientists doing this work proceed as though those traits that they believe are caused by early hormone exposures are just common sense. They're self-evident. And so you don't really need to pay too much attention to how you define and measure them. In fact, I was often greeted with puzzlement when I asked scientists, okay, well, you in some of your studies have found that, you know, early hormone exposures seem to be associated with a feminine sexuality pattern. What is feminine sexuality? And I would get a sort of a head shake and say, but that's a no-brainer, literally. And that phrase was used a number of times for me, which I thought was interesting. And likewise, sexual orientation was treated as really self-evident and not worth taking a whole lot of time to come up with detailed measures. I'm just going to read you a quote from one of the scientists who I interviewed. This is from Dr. A, I will call him. I use pseudonyms because I wanted scientists to feel free to criticize each other's work if they wanted to. I wanted to know what they thought was the best and the worst stuff out there, who had, you know, interesting approaches and so on. And so in a tradition of anthropology of science and other science and technology studies, I guaranteed them that I would only identify them by name if something about the quote mattered. So many people ask me about why don't I use their names? That's why. Okay, so Dr. A, one of the most important scientists doing this work. This is in January 1999. Fritz Klein had some complicated grid for determining sexual orientation, and Dr. In, this is Dr. A's colleague he's working with, who was doing the bulk of these interviews, said, you know, these are all nice scholarly heuristics, but 99 times out of 100, listen to the subject and they'll tell you who they are. You don't run into too many straight men who lie and say they're gay. You may have some gay men who'll tell you they're heterosexual, but not if they know the confidentiality of the project is high. And under questioning and interactions and interchange, as well as filling out questionnaires, if they're consistent, we keep them as subjects. If they check off straight and then start checking off gay, and then they tell you straight and then they tell you gay, we're just not sure what's going on. We're not sure if the person is just having fun with us. We're not sure if the person is themselves not sure of who they are. And when that would happen, we'd exclude them from participating further in the study. Now, I chose this quote because I want to just point out, if you pull two little elements from it, what he says is, listen to the subject and they'll tell you who they are. But a little bit further down, he says, if they're consistent. So you listen to the subject if they're consistent. But what methodological research on sexual behavior, orientation, and identity has shown over and over again is that inconsistency isn't noise that you weed out. Inconsistency is the phenomenon of sexuality. And if you look at sociological research, over and over, you find that those three aspects of sexuality just don't fit together for an awful lot of people, especially the domain that these scientists say they're most interested in, which is sexual desire. Very, very often, for more than half of women who have any aspect of their sexuality that where they report same-sex behavior or interest or identity, more than half of women have a mismatch between what they say they want and what they call themselves or what they say they do. And nearly half of men have that same mismatch. So in other words, and I could give other kinds of sites, but the point is that these scientists from the beginning, one of the ways that they make methodological decisions that create big gaps between the work that different scientists in this field do and between their work and other ways that we know about sexuality is to demand a certain kind of definition of sexual orientation that doesn't actually fit the phenomenon as other scientists find it to be. There are other things. I'll tell you just one other before I close up my comments and give you a chance to talk with me a little bit. Another is, imagine that I wanted to relate early hormone exposures to sexual orientation. And so I need to know what sexual orientation is. And I ask my colleagues and they say, sexual orientation is whether you're attracted to the same sex or the other sex. And somebody else tells me sexual orientation is whether you're attracted to men versus women. Well, that sounds like it's a semantic issue that's not very important, but it turns out that it's very, very important because depending on which of those two definitions you use, you group your subjects in a different way for comparisons. So see if you can follow this. I like to use pictures and a slide for this one, but let's try it. If sexual orientation is being attracted to the same versus the other sex, then gay men are like lesbians because they both want the same. And heterosexual men are like heterosexual women because they both want the other. But what if the definition is being attracted to men versus women? Then gay men are like straight women because they both want men. And lesbians are like straight men because they both want women. Now, if you have two different studies that are drawing on these two different definitions, and then you simply string the findings along and say, both of these studies show that this hormone exposure caused this outcome, what you have is this. You have two studies pointing in exactly the opposite direction. Over and over again, when you pay attention to weigh these outcomes, to the way the outcomes are actually measured, that's exactly the kind of inconsistency, gap, error that you find. There are lots of other problems as well, but those are some very big ones. Let's see if there's any other quick thing I want to tell you about before I end. I guess just that, what does this matter? What are some of the claims that are built on this theory? Why do we care if it's true or not? Well, I said it was a one-stop shopping theory. And here are a few of the stories that are held up on the back or on the basis of this theory. One of them is the old Mars versus Venus story, the idea that men and women can't communicate because we have different brains and we have different communication styles. And that a lot of times gets connected to this idea that men and women have different brain activity, where women are less lateralized. We're using the whole brain for things, and men are using one side or the other. Well, as it turns out, There's a lot of recent evidence, including a fantastic recent meta-analysis showing that lateralization contrast doesn't actually seem to be the truth when you look consistently across studies. But it's really taken as just self-evident. It's repeated over and over again. And the idea is that those differences come about because of early hormone exposures, this exact theory I'm talking about. Another one, as I mentioned, was gay brains, straight brains. What kinds of studies? That involves, you know, the familiar, some of you have heard about finger length, 2D, 4D digit ratio studies. That's one of them. Believe it or not, there are scientists who've been recently looking and again going back to an early 20th century design and comparing genital shape and size between gay men and straight men. Hip-waist ratios, exactly. Hip and waist ratios between straight women and lesbians, that sort of thing. Obviously, brain comparisons, functional imaging studies that compare men and women, gay men, straight men, etc. A very important research design that's been used a lot is the study of people with intersex syndromes, meaning people who are born with either ambiguous genitalia or genitals that are thought to not match their chromosomal type. So in other words, girls who, because of a condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, have very high androgens during development. And their genitals develop so that when they're born, they look much more like boys. Instead of a clitoris, they may have what looks like a fully formed penis, for example. Studies of girls with this condition have been very, very important. And I spend a lot of time talking about this particular set of studies in the book, in part because I think so many conclusions are made on the back of these women and girls, and in part because a persistent failure to take seriously what it means to be reared with this condition and what the medical treatment and surveillance involves in this condition, and in particular, what this theory itself has done to women and girls with this condition, such that they're not just followed medically, but they are followed very, very closely from birth to watch how their gender and sexuality are developing. They're asked over and over and over again, would you ever think you'd rather be a boy? Do you feel like a girl? On a scale of 1 to 5, how much like a girl do you feel? Do you prefer girls' toys or boys' toys? Does your little girl play with these toys or those toys? And from before birth, even parents who are seen to be at risk of having children with this condition are warned that their daughters are likely to be more masculine than other girls. So I could go on and on. The exams, the approach to these children within the overall medical research on this theory, I actually believe constitutes abuse because it's so intrusive and because there has been such a failure to take seriously what the structure of the research itself does to the people who are undergoing that. So that's something that I just wanted to put in there because it's something I feel strongly about, and because those girls in particular are always hauled out as the cream of the evidence. This is where we really can see the difference. So with that, I think I'll stop my comments and welcome your questions. I hope you'll read the book. I tried to make it as accessible as I possibly could while explaining the details of the studies, and I'm really grateful that you're here and interested to talk about it. Thank you. So the question is it's a well-known fact, you're saying, that animals turn to homosexuality, by which I'm assuming you mean same-sex behavior, during periods of overpopulation for an animal. And if that's the case, then how could a scientific theory about homosexuality as a permanent state be taken seriously? Does that capture what you asked? So the first thing I would want to do is just caution that different animals, different species, different strains of different species within different contexts and so on have really different patterns of not only sexuality, but what sex difference looks like. And to give an example, in most animals, what gets counted as homosexuality has traditionally, until very, very recently, been if an animal of one sex actually exhibits sexual behavior that is associated with the other sex. So what does that mean? In the small animals that are typically studied in labs, that means, is an animal mounting other animals, or is an animal allowing itself to be mounted? In small rodents, this involves a position called lordosis, where they arch their back and present the rump. But it turns out that males and females of virtually every species do both of those behaviors, whether or not there's overpopulation, whether or not they've been treated with hormones. The question is just how much? What's the ratio of one behavior to the other, and what's the amount, what's the sex difference in frequency of one or other behavior? And that ratio changes with a lot of interesting things. Again, species to species it changes, the particular strain of a particular species, housing conditions, age of the animal, the rearing conditions, what kind of sexual experience did the adults that they're reared with have. All of those things actually change the ratio of those behaviors. So all of this is to say that this, I think it speaks back to your point that looking at this like it's something fixed and dichotomous doesn't work from so many different angles. If you look at sheep, sheep are an example of an animal that's been studied with a different model for what would constitute homosexuality in this animal. So that with rams, instead of counting rams that allow themselves to be mounted as gay rams, which the New York Times, by the way, used gay rams in a headline, which just cracked me up. I thought, that's okay. That's really, we have a hard time in my world deciding which people to call gay or straight. So that was fascinating, but that's a digression. So the gay rams were rams that preferentially mounted other rams, even if a female sheep, in heat was present, and they went through a number of different tests and trials and so on. And so to a lot of people, this looked like a better test of sexual orientation than whether or not an animal allowed itself to be mounted, because as many people have noted, gay men and lesbians both do all kinds of different things with each other. And so just doing some kind of behavior, cross-sex behavior, isn't a good test. So there's been a lot of attention to this idea of these gay rams who seem to appear in both wild and semi-wild settings as they've been observed. But there was a fantastically interesting study that came out in the maybe a year after the first study that reported this method, this new way of determining sexual orientation in rams. A couple of more studies came out talking about how they were refining the test and had determined, you know, quite a few rams in this herd were just naturally male-oriented instead of female-oriented. But another study that same year was taking a look at the genetic, at how to gauge how effective a sire different rams were. So they were testing to see how many of the different rams had sired lambs in the herd that year. And it turned out that a huge proportion, probably all, of the so-called male-oriented rams had sired offspring. In fact, not here and there, but of, I believe it was 7 male-oriented rams had sired hundreds of the lambs in that herd. And in terms of the proportion that they were siring compared to the so-called female-oriented rams, they fell about halfway between female-oriented rams that had been rated as really, really strongly female-oriented and weakly female-oriented, but female-oriented. So in other words, these male-oriented rams were sort of middle-of-the-road breeders when it came to what they were doing when the scientists weren't testing them for sexual orientation. What does this say? This says that context really matters. And again, this is back to your question. The context matters. Who else is in the herd? Some of these things that are looked at as sexual behavior in animals are about a lot of other things. They can be about play. It can be about dominance. It can be about all kinds of other ends. So it's really complicated to try to draw those parallels. But even in the animals where people are trying to draw those parallels, it's not nearly as tidy and cut and dried as this theory requires it to be in order for the theory to be true. Question is, how has my research, and he notes that I've been doing this for more than a decade, which is right, how has my research changed the work of these 21 scientists or presumably anybody else doing this kind of study? That's probably the most depressing question that I've been asked in my entire running around talking about the book, because to my knowledge, it hasn't changed what they're doing at all. But I didn't actually think it was going to change the work, especially of those scientists who are the most prominent. Why? They've built their careers on this theory. They have not only built their careers, it's not just personal investment. They have grant proposals that are built on this theory. They have entire laboratories. They have postdocs that are funded based on this theory and on testing it. In a sense, the higher up you go, the more influential the people are in this work, the less likely it is that an analysis like this is going to be able to budge them, because it's not just their ideas. There's a lot of investment, literally money, as well as, you know, there's metal and research instruments and other people and careers involved in this theory. But there are some inklings that it has changed some of the people in the pipeline and the way they're thinking. So, for example, I've had the opportunity to present about my work for quite a while, including for a number of years before the book itself was finished. And there have been a number of times when either postdocs or people during their doctoral training would come up to me and say, "This is amazing. Can you give me references? And can we talk about what kind of study could we be doing that where I could, I'm really interested in hormones and sexual behavior. What else could we be doing?" And I don't know, I can't actually give you back what specific research designs people have picked up, but from young people in the pipeline, there's some change. There's one other thing I'll mention, which is somebody who did her doctoral research on this this theory, and in the course of her work, was really disappointed to find that she was actually studying using a research design involving twins. So there's the idea that same-sex versus other-sex twins could give you one test of this theory. Like many of the research designs, there are some conceptual problems in drawing that, but I'll leave those aside. So the idea is a girl who is in the womb with a male fetus is going to be exposed to different hormones than a girl who's in the womb with another girl. And you could compare them on a group level and see, does there seem to be an effect? Well, what this young scientist, Selena Cohen-Bendahan, told me was that when she had been at a bunch of scientific meetings and asked other twin researchers what they had seen, she found over and over again that people said they had looked in their data and they hadn't found any indication. And this was a really great example of what's been called the file drawer problem. None of those people had ever written about it because there was nothing to write about. They looked for it and they didn't find it. Who writes about it? The people who look for it and they find the difference. But what that means is that an overwhelming number of people who are looking in their data and not finding the expected difference, nobody ever knows about that. Journals don't like to publish negative results. Try it if you haven't already done that. It's really, really difficult. The standards for publishing negative findings are much, much more stringent. It doesn't make a research career. It'll never make a headline. Your university won't give you a press release, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So nobody bothers to publish those studies. She gave up that line of inquiry. And I can't speak to her, but I can say I'm hopeful about this, that a number of folks that I've talked to have to me expressed skepticism, more skepticism after our conversations, that just a better research design would be the answer. And they're starting to think about maybe a different way to imagine the relationship between our biology and our behavior. I think that the gist of it is that there, do I see any way around the problem of having preconceptions about the nature of sex differences, in addition to just having a good model or not? Are you asking whether you think that just preconceptions about what sex differences are and where they come from may fatally flaw this kind of research? Okay, so not just sex differences, but across the board. Okay. Okay, so do preconceptions fatally flaw investigations? Well, yes and no. When I talk about the book, sometimes I have started out by talking about what would I mean when I say the flaws in the science of sex differences. What do we mean flaws? And I think it's useful to think about flaw in two different ways. One sense of flaw, you could think of a geological or topographical sense as a crack that runs through something that looks solid and seems quite solid and uniform and unitary, and cracks that run through and split things that start as one into many, or that seem like one into many. And another way of thinking about flaws is simply errors, mistakes, problems. And I try to use that sense of flaw in both ways in this book. In terms of error, problem, misconception, I think we can agree that science, that some kinds of science, some fields of science, some issues on which there are inquiries, do a much worse job than others. And I think that sex differences is a particularly tough area to get right because, for a few reasons, because our beliefs are so important to our social world and our daily interactions and our language, all of that. And because we ourselves, all of us, are personally associated with one or the other of the categories being explored. Our investments run so deep in this realm that it's really tricky. There's a second reason, which is related to why all these scientists told me that masculine sexuality, feminine sexuality, homosexuality, just common sense. They're using the same terms in their work, literally, that we use in our daily lives in very casual and different ways. So very often, it's not just a conceptual problem, but what I sometimes think of as a problem of doubling in the language, that they're drawing on the same terms that we use in casual ways with a variety of meanings all the time. And for that reason, there's way more messiness and just resonance with the social world built in to this line of inquiry than there is in, you know, astrophysics, where we don't use the words and terms and concepts to draw on in our daily interactions with each other. That's not to say that I don't think that people's preconceptions and their social worlds, the social organization of a lab, and so their worldview affects how they do astrophysics. I think we have lots of data that it does, in fact, and that science and technology studies in general broadly shows that it really matters what a scientist thinks and who they are and so on to how they do the work. Serious thinking about objectivity is very different than it was 50 years ago. But some work is harder to do than other work. And looking forward, what I would say about that question is that it's a good cautionary tale for how to do better behavioral biology. And I think that one really important thing is to stop obsessing about sex difference, but to actually think about other aspects of human variety and difference that are less saturated with the way we routinely organize our social world. What did I find with regards to trans research? Great question. In this body of work, in general, I'll start historically. Initially, all of the scientists doing this work on humans imagined that masculinity and femininity in the brain was running on a sort of a spectrum from all the way male to all the way female. It all ran on one continuum. And that could be that continuum, depending on hormone exposures, was available to males or females genetically or, you know, phenotypically in terms of the body. So what that meant on that continuum was all the way over on this end, if, let's say, a female-bodied person, a genetically XX person, had a masculine brain, the most masculine would make me transsexual. It would make me, and that was the term they were using then, not transgender or just trans. So the idea was I would literally identify as and feel as if I were a man. And then back up a little bit less masculine, a little bit less male typical hormone exposures, and I would be a lesbian and exclusively attracted and probably a career woman, and which they really were deeply suspicious of early on. I would also have what, you know, just a mere 20 years earlier was referred to in psychological research as sex bitterness, meaning that when these folks did their first research in the 60s, some of the questions they asked routinely of girls and women were, who do you think has a better deal in life, boys or girls, men or women? And any kinds of answers to questions like that that indicated that women felt in any way that the social world was unfair indicated that maybe they'd had just a little bit too much testosterone in utero. So this string, and so obviously now the definitions have switched around, but you'll often find citations to those studies. They won't anymore in a current day study mention that particular finding, but those studies are still strung in with contemporary studies, just to give you a sense of some of the problems. What's going on more recently, it's still the case that scientists doing this work in general don't explicitly lay that model out anymore, but implicitly it's still there. And there are very few folks who break from that. One group, although I'm extremely critical of this group in other ways, one group that's broken from that model is Dick Swab in the Netherlands, who's a neuroscientist. And his group actually has paid attention to the fact that transgender people may have sexual orientation to either the same or the other sex, for example. So they're starting to treat gender identity, whether you identify as male or female, as different from sexual orientation, who you're attracted to. And so that disrupts this, you know, spectrum thing a little bit. But, excuse me, in general, they're still drawing on data in many, many ways that's problematic, including, again, ignoring large studies that show that early hormones have no effect on gender identity, for example, or really, really overblowing the claims that are made about gender identity and sexual orientation in girls with CIH, who I mentioned before. So there's definitely a lot of work on this, and I do consider it as part of the mix. There are fewer people doing that work than the other work. But it doesn't hold up any better than the rest of it. These studies do not, to my knowledge, if there's something out in the last month or two that has done this, I haven't seen it. But before that, no, the studies themselves in the work are not saying different schools would be a great idea. Some of the studies do, by the time they get to the conclusion, actually talk about sex difference in occupations, for example, and say that given this kind of difference in, say, fundamental interests or in fundamental cognitive abilities, which most of them have abandoned because basically almost all of that has disappeared. But they do... a few of them point right in the research articles to the implications for programs that would seek equity in the occupations. But even though you don't see mention of schooling in the articles, a lot of these people have started talking about single-sex versus mixed-sex education. When they're interviewed, they're drawn on by people like Leonard Sachs, who's somebody who's really popularized the idea of hardwired sex differences being the reason to do single-sex education. So I am both an alum and a professor at a single-sex institution, and I want to go on record as saying I think single-sex education, in particular women's higher education, is a really good idea. There are lots of reasons to support that have to do with the outcomes, the fact that more women who go to women's colleges end up getting PhDs. There are many more graduates that in the traditionally and still overwhelmingly male fields of math and science, in particular physics, engineering, and so on. And I could go on with the wonderful outcomes that you see with women's colleges, not that I think they're for everybody, but they don't work because we have different brains. That's clear enough. They work for very different reasons. But I think that we should really be alert to the fact that this hardwiring story is being recruited and touted all over the place as a reason to have single-sex education early on. And one of the real tragedies about that is the kind of sex typing that gets built into these single-sex curricula is really horrifying. One place where you can read about that in a nice way, there are two places. I would send you to Language Log, which is a brilliant and hilarious blog that's written by the linguist Mark Lieberman at the University of Pennsylvania. He's unbelievable. He just spits things out like nobody's business, and he talks about this a lot. So do some searches on Language Log. The other place where this whole issue is covered very well is in a recent book by Cordelia Fine called Delusions of Gender. Cordelia's book has been reviewed with mine a lot. It's great timing. They're very complimentary. I take on this theory and look very specifically at this one underlying causal theory. What she does is look at the social psychology evidence about gender socialization and gender differences and takes a look at what are the patterns broadly of gender differences in the world. And in particular, her stuff around single-sex education is very compelling. Okay, I haven't studied this. But the question is, why does single-sex education work? I will give an answer. Even though I haven't studied it, it's my opinion about why it works. I will tell you some research that backs up the opinion. It's not a completely out-of-the-air opinion. I think that it works because of the structure of the learning environment. And I'll give you an example of what goes on at Barnard, where I teach. At Barnard, even though the classrooms themselves are mixed sex, all of the student organizations at the institution are obviously, because all of the student body of Barnard is women, they are populating all of the leadership of every student organization. They are very clear, walking into every classroom, that they belong in that classroom, regardless of what's being taught. So it doesn't matter if what's being taught is something that's thought of as a typically male, a topic that men are typically better at. They know they have some ownership over the place, and there's something about their ownership that makes them less hesitant to speak up in a classroom, even if they do have male peers present. They have many more opportunities for leadership on the campus. And the administration and professors are there primarily to actually see to the intellectual development of our women students. We all recognize that that's our obligation. And those things really make a difference. Now, what's some of the social psych literature, for example, that would back that up? The idea of having ownership in a classroom, one way you could think about that is in relation to something called stereotype threat. Stereotype threat, there's a fantastic body of research on this idea that the way people perform in a job or in an academic setting or in any kind of setting is very, very sensitive to what is expected of them and to what they think people like them typically do. So stereotype threat has been shown to really operate a lot to affect the performance of any group when something about their group membership is associated with doing well or poorly on a task. So, for example, if girls are given a test in math or science, even without in advance telling them this particular test is something that boys usually do better on, but you'll probably do fine because you've gotten good grades in math. If you tell them that, even if you say you'll probably do fine, they do worse than if you say nothing. It turns out that if you tell them there's no sex difference on this test, they do better than if you tell them nothing. What that implies is that walking into a math test or a science test, stereotype threat is already operating for girls and women just because that stereotype is so broadly pervasive. So just saying this particular test, there's no sex difference. What's really fascinating is if you tell them, you know, recent research shows that due to genetic reasons, women do better on this kind of test. So you tell them, as Cordelia would say, a big fat lie. They do even better than the boys on that test when they're told that. They do better than the girls who are told there's no sex difference. What this means is, and these are studies that have been done in many, many, many settings. They've been replicated in lots of ways. I can't tell you all the varieties of them. But I will say that it turns out that when you're talking about math and science or engineering, simply taking the test in the presence of boys or men for college-aged women actually reduces their performance. It's sad, but the truth is that we are so far from an equal world that I think it's premature to pretend that we're already there and say, oh, let's not make it salient. It's already salient. And so what single-sex education in certain contexts does is take seriously the fact that we're far from an equal world, and it takes seriously the data we have on how that matters, and it tries to equalize things during an important time period in education and development. The question is, am I as sympathetic to single-sex education for young men? And I want to point out that neither men nor women are homogenous groups. And there are particular groups of young men that I think, where I do think single-sex education is a particularly good idea. One reason that this whole hardwiring story doesn't pass the smell test is that if you look at different subgroups of girls and boys and men and women, you see very different patterns of sex differences. So if you look at Euro-American, a.k.a. white kids, particularly in middle and upper classes, you see the pattern that we're used to as thinking about the typical male-female pattern, where boys outperform girls on math and science. You see that in a much less pronounced way these days if you move further down the class ladder. What's really interesting is what happens if you look at African-American kids in the U.S. context. In many, many cases, you see that sex difference reversed. Now, So what's going on there? What's going on there is a very different social context. What it means to be a girl or a boy is different depending on what your whole social context is. And in particular, because stereotype threats about academic performance aren't just about sex, but they're very racialized too. There are many, many, many stereotypes that especially African Americans are not going to do well academically, and particularly African American boys. And for that reason, I think that there really is a lot of promise in having an environment that would give those kids the same kinds of little ring of support, ring of counteracting the stereotype threat that operates. The same thing is true of African-American girls. I mean, we can think about how does stereotype threat operate. And the issue right now is, we're at a point in time where there isn't any stereotype that is particularly credible, for white boys about the stereotype has to do with behavioral problems. And in fact, a lot of these single-sex schools built on this hardwiring idea play to the idea that these boys innately have behavioral problems. So I think that the whole process operates differently, and it operates differently not because of something different in brains or whatever, or not because everybody shouldn't deserve opportunities, but because it's about social structures and power and looking at, who ends up right now in the most privileged position already anyway, and what kinds of interventions could we do that are about actually challenging that instead of reproducing it. So, do I think there's no biological basis for a person's development of interests at all? No, I don't think that. I think our bodies matter to who we are, to who we become, to what we feel like. But I think they matter in really complicated ways that cannot be boiled down to pink and blue. Because what we're interested in and our cognitive skills, our personalities, and so on, aren't actually well divided by sex, I think that's a poor place to look for our differences. But I can give you a couple of examples of how I think biology would matter. And simply our perceptual apparatuses, so that different people process sights in different ways from very, very early on. I think that can orient us towards different stimuli our response to those different stimuli then puts us in different situations, calling into play a whole looping process, a cascade of effects that engages us differently with the world over a long process of development. The same thing could be true for something as straightforward as different tactile sensitivities and sensibilities. At what level does touch become pleasure instead of tickle or painful for different people, and where? These seem like, well, what would that have to do with interests? But I can actually draw a plausible trajectory from an initial difference that's a biological difference, whether it's about hearing, sensitivity to certain smells, or the ability to perceive different kinds of smells, different visual apparatus, as I said, all of those things. So that's one quick example of how I think it's absolutely easy to think about how biology affects who we are, what we like, what we want to do, without it being a simplistic story that's either about our fate. Notice that that was not something that said, I am innately somebody who's going to really love chocolate. That, and I don't think that kind of, you know, innate difference thing is the way to think about biology. Okay, the question, I'll try to repeat it so you can get it, is given that over the course of human evolution, we lived in caves much longer than houses, that there's this long period of time where early humans were staying home, men were going out hunting, etc., that these early roles, how could that sort of early history as hunters and gatherers not affect who we are now? Does that capture your question? Okay. So the first thing I would do is say that story about man the hunter and woman the gatherer is a lot of conjecture on very thin evidence. And in fact, there's a lot of very interesting evidence that suggests that early humans didn't sex differentiate when they went hunting, for example. That hunting, we tend to think, I mean, the story, the stereotypical, you know, archetypal story, man the hunter, is about going out and getting the big game. All the guys get together, they get their spears, they go out for days and hunt the buffalo. But in fact, over the last 10 or 15 years, some archaeologists have had the great luck of doing some digs in the tundra, where the freezing has meant that the degradation of soft materials has not been the same as in other places. What they have found have been incredibly early nets, for example. They've found evidence of different kinds of tools that you don't find in other sites, not because they weren't there, but because those materials degrade. And the evidence in these sites suggests that hunting was a communal activity, that everybody would, for example, set traps, that it would take a whole big group to chase the herd over the cliff, and that most of the hunting didn't involve big game where they went off for days, but it was little animals around. So, in other words, obviously, I believe in evolution. I believe that evolution, if you believe in evolution, you can't avoid thinking that evolution has shaped who we are and what our capacities are. But I think the way that that's shaped human capacity is to endow us with an enormous amount of flexibility behaviorally. And that the risk with looking backwards in time and thinking about, you know, well, doesn't that arrangement affect how we are right now, is that what we make of that arrangement is based entirely on what we know from right now, and that these tales about, you know, family arrangement or hunting practices and so on are often made on unbelievably thin data and are only now, this man the hunter story is a really good one that you almost never see challenged, but it's actually, it's really conjecture. So I hope that helps. Thank you so much, all of you, for good questions.